started, and I'm going to call the meeting to order. We don't have a quorum yet, but we can, Representative Hanson, we can start to hear your bill. We won't move it yet, but we'll start to hear it. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think this is the first time I've been in front of your committee ever.
Special welcome.
So.
We don't make people bring cookies, if that's what you're wondering.
Pleased to be here. House File 1983 is a housing bill that's specific for Dakota County, where we're looking at tax credits in transit areas. And I have staff here from Dakota County who've worked in the housing issues for quite some time. We do have an amendment that's an author's amendment once you get a quorum that I'd like to put on, but of our Dakota County friends here, give us a little background on the bill.
Yep. Madam Chair, members, Mark Ulfers, the Executive Director with the Dakota County Community Development Agency.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Karen and Madam Chair, and it's good to see you again.
That's right, we're familiar with each other.
Yes,
you've done a lot of good work over the years, a lot of good work.
In a good way, I hope.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. The CDA was actually created by a special act of the state legislature back in 71. And over that time, we've grown to do a lot of different activities. We manage over 30 different programs that touch on both affordable housing, but also community development needs in the county. In the affordable housing area alone, on a daily basis, we serve more than 10,000 clients, ranging from the homeless to young families purchasing their first homes. We strive to provide a variety of different programs to assist with the development and redevelopment needs of our county. Dakota County now is a very diverse place, much more diverse than when I started in 1977. And we're dealing with many, many challenges, some of them new. Since 1990, the CDA has used the housing tax credit to produce 1,300 units of affordable housing for families, almost exclusively larger family housing. We have constructed new homes, we've rehabilitated older homes, and we've built housing for special needs groups like young adult homeless and the disabled. As our county continues to develop, providing transit has become an important priority. The red line down Cedar Avenue was opened last June, and more potential lines along 35W, South Robert Street, and Hastings are in the planning stages. This proposed legislation would authorize us to conduct a pilot of up to three projects that meet the criteria of a transit-oriented development, or TOD. Specifically, it would provide us with more flexibility with the bedroom sizes allowed in the development. This would enable us to better match the size of the units with the market research and who is most likely to want to live in this kind of location. In addition, we are responding as an agency to research that was done by the Corridors of Opportunity Commission, which published a report calling for this exact legislation to be considered to give the CDA better tools for addressing this need. You know, there's been a lot of urban transit-oriented development done, but very little yet in the suburbs. And so we're hoping with this, we can create a couple pilot projects and then report back to others as to, you know, our success. So we appreciate very much your time this afternoon and would welcome any comments or questions.
Thank you. I wonder if we should hear from your second witness and then we'll go ahead with questions.
Sure, my name is Andrea Brennan. I'm the Director of Community and Economic Development for the Dakota County CDA, and I would also be happy to answer any questions that
okay.
you may have.
Okay, there we go. Representative Isaacson, I think you had your hand up.
Thank you. Well, I first would tell you that any type of work we can do to develop models in the suburban areas are a good idea. I think we don't do enough of that. I know my suburbs that I serve are poorly served by transit, and we're not really set up for that the way we'd like to. I do have a couple questions, however, that when we talk about, and I want to be clear that the language is the same in my head as what you mean, multi-family housing, we're talking about basically just your basic apartments, is that correct? Are we also talking about the possibility of actual homes?
Madam Chair and Representative, we are talking most likely in this instance about apartments at this specific in these specific areas. However, you know, it may be possible as we step further away from the transit sites to do higher density, what we call single family detached housing, which is high density or higher density single family detached. Mm-hmm. I think for the most part it will be in an apartment setting. And what we hope to accomplish here is not creating developments that are 100% affordable, but we're really interested in a mixed income type mm-hmm. of product, where 20 or maybe 40 percent of the units at the most would be affordable. The rest would be market rates, so we would serve a range of income. Mm-hmm. And then by having, you know, these units located near transit, it would give opportunity for people to use transit as a primary means. Mm-hmm. However, from our experience in the suburbs, we still think in most cases people are going to need one car. Although, if we can get people down to one car, that's progress. And in some cases, I think some people will be able to do without any cars at all.
Excellent.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just another question. When we talk about, and my understanding of the bill is that it takes the threshold from one level and is allowing us to use it for one-bedroom apartments at a higher level. Is that correct? Am I reading that right? I just want to make sure I get that right.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, the current criteria that we use in developing family housing that we need to follow requires 75% of the units in a development to be two-bedroom or greater. Mm-hmm. And then of that 75%, one-third have to be three-bedroom or larger, so the remaining 25% could be one-bedroom. Mm-hmm. Actually, when we do this kind of housing, we don't do any one-bedrooms. We do all twos and threes because mm-hmm. we're really trying to emphasize families. But in this context, we want to have the flexibility to have more ones, efficiencies, maybe more twos, less threes, just give us more flexibility.
Which makes sense, but I'm wondering why we're raising the bar. Why not capture everybody at a lower rate? Or at a lower, how do I put this, at the 30% rate? Maybe I didn't understand that correctly. Help me.
Ms. Brennan?
Andrea? Yeah.
Sure. I mean, just to clarify one point, the income requirements will be the same. So the federal tax credit program requires that households with an income at or below 60% of the area median income are served, and that will not change. So we're not proposing to serve any higher income group than what is currently permitted.
And that's the same as for one bedrooms as two and three bedrooms, the same amount, or is it the lower?
Yes, the income is adjusted by household size, and then the rent is also adjusted by the number of bedrooms.
Got it.
Representative Isaacson. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And so what you're doing is, I think I maybe misunderstood something when I read the bill, so I'm just trying to make sure I understand that. And so we're not saying that we're going to put one bedrooms in at a higher rate at 60%. We're saying we're being conforming with that. Okay, good. And then I guess that helps answer my second question. I wanted to make sure that we weren't forsaking the lower amount for the higher amount, and then we have less of the lower amount that we need to also be serving that community at the same time. So I don't want it to be a deal where we're creating a model that we all of a sudden are now putting in higher levels because that's more lucrative or whatever, but we're not serving the lower population as well in terms of income.
Right. Madam Chair and Representative, this gives me an opportunity to talk a little about the CDA's philosophy.
Wonderful.
About affordable housing. We are probably the provider of the lowest, most affordable rents in tax credit housing in the metropolitan area. So we go further than just rents at 30% of 50% of median income. Most of our rents are around 30% of 33% of median income, which allows us to serve a much lower income household. And we do that by bringing in a lot of local Dakota County resources to make the rents more affordable. So we're not satisfied with the state and the federal guidelines on rents. We want to bring those down substantially so we can serve a broader range of affordable housing needs.
If I can just illustrate that point, the 60% rent limit for a one-bedroom apartment unit is $933. The CDA and the CDA-owned properties, our rent for a one-bedroom unit is $585 a month. So, you know, it's 350 dollars less than what is permitted under the tax credit rules.
Representative Isaacson.
Wonderful. And the last question I have is, and Representative Hansen, maybe you can answer this, is that you guys are doing a pilot. When are you going to report back or let us know the results of that to see if that's something that was beneficial? And
if I could maybe help with that,
Mr. Alfers.
Madam Chair, Representatives, what our intention is, if we have this piece of legislation, we will now have, in our opinions, a feasible financial model.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a couple of potential sites.
Mm-hmm.
So given the way the tax credits are allocated, the earliest we could be under construction is 2016,
sure.
Completed in 2017. So I would say, you know, sometime in, you know, after that time frame. And, you know, frankly, a lot of my colleagues in the suburbs are going to be interested to see what happens here because, as you say, more transit is being considered in the suburban areas and people are interested in, you know, what kind of models work.
And Representative Hansen?
Madam Chair and Representative Isaacson, specifically to your question, rather than putting in a date saying we must report by this date, we will report when the projects are done.
Okay.
So
is that in there somewhere?
Where's Isaacson?
Sorry.
Okay. Madam Chair, that's implied that that's implied in it that would be completed.
My only request would be that there is something that really made sure that we heard back and we knew what kind of projects you actually specifically did and how that resolved. Otherwise, that satisfies my questions. Thank you very much.
Mr. Alfers?
Madam Chair, Representative, completely think that's a great idea. It's our intention to see what we can learn.
Okay. Any other questions? Concerns? Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifiers, and just as a matter of policy, you know, in the 60s and 70s, we spent a lot of time and energy to break up corridors of low income. Why are we going through a central planning now? I mean, I understand the nexus of having low income and needing a place to live, and that probably means you don't have transportation as well, but I think it's a mistake to be doing this central planning and concentrating all of a similar type of housing along corridors. I could support this bill if you just took out the requirements about being located along a corridor. And certainly high-frequency bus lines can be run anywhere and can provide on their routes where these might happen to be constructed. But to be a property owner or a landowner that happens to own real estate along a proposed or light rail corridor is really central planning at its greatest to design a benefit for certain targeted people in terms of the development potential, and that inordinately influences the value or the market price, especially if things are being subsidized. So I would discourage, I support the idea that you want to help people who need help and that we ought to be building or providing opportunities for folks, but I think it's a grave mistake to embark upon something we decided 30, 40 years ago was something we wanted to not see socioeconomic groups all concentrated into ghettos and corridors. You can, if you had those chances or opportunities to visit our major metropolitan areas where poverty was concentrated, I think that's a mistake. And so I think we ought to be departing from this central planning notion of concentrating all of the same type of housing all together. Mm-hmm. I think it even, I guess I don't need to say any more. I think I've made my point.
Mr. Alfers, did you?
I would, Madam Chair, Representative, the principles that you're discussing are ones that very much resonate with Dakota County. We have a policy of not locating more than 50 units of affordable housing in an area or location, and that was from our experience as a county. Both with a couple of early private projects that were done, but also in observing what had happened in metropolitan areas. in this instance, you know, the county, the state of Minnesota, Metro Council are, you know, providing a lot of resource around creating transit. And so we're trying to provide, I guess you'd call it locational efficiency, trying to make it efficient for affordable housing to be able to access this resource. We're pragmatic people at the CDA, and so we're trying to respond to what is and provide a product that works. Our suburban communities that this goes through have, in for the most part, very limited affordable housing. For example, the Cedar Red Line goes through Eagan, Apple Valley, and then will end eventually when it's completed in Lakeville. So these are areas that are very much concerned about those principles of concentration of poverty. And I think, frankly, I'd be run out of the county if I did something that created that kind of a situation, because it is very important to us that we get the affordable housing policy right.
Representative Hertas?
Well, thank you for that explanation. But just as a counter comment, no matter where you are in the metro right now, and particularly even with the Metropolitan Council and planning all these light rail corridors, it's not really the government's responsibility to be establishing the development pattern. I mean, the market really responds to where people want to go and whatnot, and the whole notion of the different lines going different directions, the whole momentum for this is build it and they'll come, and like government is now the developer, and I just think the central planning is a bad idea.
Any further comments?
Madam Chair, Representative, appreciate those comments. The one point I would like to clarify is that, in great likelihood, we're a finance agency at the local level, and our intent here and our goal for a private developer to do this housing, not the agency or government. We, though, are in a position of being asked to provide resources.
Thank you. I think that Representative Hertas, anything else?
No, I'm done. Thanks.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I think that was a very helpful explanation, and I do want to say that Dakota County has an excellent record for providing a lot of mixed housing, and I think you were a leader in that many, many years ago before you and I either had gray hair. That was something you were doing. So I want to thank you for that. And members, we now have a quorum. I'm going to call the meeting to order officially. And who would like to move Representative Hansen's bill?
Peter would.
Representative Fisher would like to move House File 1983. And you do have an amendment.
Yes.
And so Representative Fisher also moves that amendment. Would you explain the amendment, please?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the A1 amendment does the for up to three. So this is the cap on the number of projects, and then there would be implied in that the reporting back. So rather than the threshold criteria being changed, it's going to be for three projects.
All right. Any discussion on the amendment? It puts it in the order the author wants it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. Motion prevails. And so the bill as amended is before us, House File 1983, to be re-referred to taxes. Right, Representative Fisher, we're referring it to taxes.
Madam Chair, if I could just make a...
Representative Hansen, would you like to make some final comments?
This morning I had, and I think many of you have had, students from alternative high schools, and when talking with them from my district, and I would encourage, some of you may make it to Lilydale for a fine food. If you go down Robert Street, you're in my district, and they brought up housing and transportation because we have a lot of lots of apartments. Many of them lived in apartments, and whether it's the public market or the private market, this is a need. There's a need for housing, and there's a need for transportation. They don't have cars. They're struggling, proximity to work, proximity to the schools, proximity to the schools, proximity to their friends. We have, and I can show you maps of my districts, we have A lot of seniors in West St. Paul, but a very changing county in terms of its makeup. And so I want to just impress them on folks, there is a need there, whether it's central planning or the market. This comes down to real people who are looking for something that they can afford so that they can live and live the American dream. So I'd appreciate your support.
Thank you. If no further discussion, then the House file is before us, 1983, to be referred to taxes.
Thank you.
As amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and you're on your way to taxes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Next bill is House File 2203, Representative Halverson. Representative Isaacson, I see you have a motion.
I'd like to move House File 2203.
Representative Isaacson moves House File 2203 be re-referred to Health and Human Services Finance. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I come before you today with a request for the Homeless Youth Act. We came before you last session and asked for $8 million for the Homeless Youth Act, and we were graciously awarded $4 million, which has been distributed, and we can't wait to talk about the results of that distribution and also about the continuing need. I do have some testifiers who would like to be heard who do need to leave, so if it's okay. All right with you,
sure,
I'd let them visit with you.
We'll go right ahead of that. Welcome to the committee, and just introduce yourself, please.
Thanks. Chairperson Clark, committee members, staff, guests. My name is Greg Owen. This is my colleague, Michelle Girard. Together, we're responsible for the Minnesota Statewide Homeless Survey. We've been conducting it statewide since 1991. At that time, we began interviewing, as part of the study, youth who were homeless and on their own. Today I'd like to talk a little bit about the results and the findings from that study. Just to be clear, Wilder Research is separate and independent from any of the program or policy arms of Wilder. We provide an independent voice and objective facts about the research, and that's what we're here to do today. The definition of homeless youth over the time period of the study has shifted, and one of the things that's happened is that we've now included in that definition youth who are with other families or who are with friends' families, who are doubled up, and a substantial number of youth in this situation are very difficult to find. We do a very thorough job. We found in our latest study 1,151 young people, 21 and younger, who were on their own and homeless on October 25th, 2012. That was the eighth cycle of this study, so we have a lot of experience at looking at what we're getting in terms of the data and what the characteristics of the youth are. We know one of the important differences in terms of what we find in our study is that we have youth who are more likely connected to services. They're found through outreach workers. They are sometimes in shelters, but the number of shelters in Minnesota for youth is very small. Most youth, in fact, are actually staying in adult shelters in Minnesota. So again, to repeat, the total number of youth found on this one night was 1,151, and about 150 of those youth were under 17 or younger. And so that means that those were all minor youth. Their age of entry into homelessness, their average age of entry into homelessness is about 14 to 15, compared to the young adults, the 18 to 21-year-olds, their average age is about 17. So we have some difference in these two populations. One would be regarded as a very vulnerable population. Other more transition age youth may be coming out of foster care, we know that they have had a history of placement oftentimes in their background. So I just want to share a few of the facts from the study, and then we're open to any questions that you have. When we look at the entire age group of those 21 and younger, we find that one-third have spent at least one night sleeping outside, and half have spent at least one night doubled up in the month preceding the survey. So that further complicates the matter of finding homeless youth. Of all of the parts of the population of homelessness that we try to identify and enumerate and interview on the night of the survey, the youth population is the most difficult to find. Roughly 54% of all the youth in the Twin Cities and 65% of all those in Greater Minnesota have been in some form of out-of-home placement, including about 40% who have been in foster care. 60% of the youth that we interview have had at least one parent who has been incarcerated. Half of all of the youth have a persistent or mental health problem. This is determined by a set of national health interview questions that we ask. They respond to a series of questions about whether or not they've been told by a doctor or nurse within the past 2 years if they have one of the following diagnoses. 27% have been sexually abused as children, 31% neglected, 44% physically abused. At least half, 55%, have experienced one of these forms of child maltreatment. So this is often a traumatized population, oftentimes bad starts in their circumstances in life. Significant racial disparities exist in this population. They have been persistent throughout the arc of the study from 1991 to 2012. Approximately half of all homeless youth in the metro area are African American, and in Greater Minnesota, one in five is an American Indian. Most of the homeless youth in Minnesota are homegrown. That is 76% are from Minnesota. They're not imports. And often when we ask follow-up questions about this, we learn that if they're in Minnesota now and they have not been, they did not grow up in Minnesota, they often have some other type of connection with a family member here. 15% of youth identify themselves as GLBT. These numbers are a little lower than some national, other studies that are done nationally. However, we found that those, in comparison to those studies are often looking specifically at GLBT services. And so we think 15% is really closer to the mark in terms of the presence of GLBT youth in this population. Roughly 30% of the youth are parents, about 40% of all the females in the population are parents, and nearly one quarter, 23%, have an evidence of a traumatic brain injury. So again, with traumatic brain injury, oftentimes you have a difficulty sequencing, so following instructions. This makes, again, providing service and making services stick more difficult. There's good news. 95% of all minors were enrolled in school. 7 out of 10 attended school on the day that we interviewed them that were basically of high school age or lower. Among those 19 and older, 58% had completed high school. 31% of the youth we interviewed had some type of employment. So those are the cold hard stats from the study. I'll leave my remarks with you. They're a little bit more detailed. We have a study that Michelle is just finishing preparation of on homeless youth that will be out in early April. So all of that information will be available to this committee. I just want to relate one story before I close, and that's at the Drake Hotel when I was interviewing. I was managing the study there, and we were shorthanded. I had to conduct one interview with one homeless youth that was there. She was in the lobby because they didn't know quite what to do with her. It's an adult shelter. She was 15 years old. She told me that she couldn't go home even though her mother was in the Twin Cities because her mother was an addict and it was not safe to be at her house. I asked who was with her. She said it was her 10-year-old brother and her one-and-a-half-year-old child. That was a very sobering picture for me. It sort of took me off my pins. Helped me to not fill out the survey correctly, the survey which I had designed, because I was so flustered by what I saw. And it doesn't seem to me this is something that we want to see continue in Minnesota. I'll take questions, and so will Michelle.
Thank you. Do you want to provide your testimony first, and then we'll take questions?
Oh, my name is Michelle Girard, and I'm the co-research director for the Statewide Homeless Study.
Okay, I guess we're ready for questions. Committee members?
Yeah.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm surprised I'm first. I just held up my hand, though. I was reading when you were talking kind of fast, so I was just get some clarification from you. You said that the definition of youth has changed, and a homeless youth has changed, and so I'm wondering what prompted the change in the definition, and you had said something about you were counting youth who actually had a place to stay, but it was not
a permanent home.
Okay.
It was more on an emergency basis.
Can you clarify that also, where that is and what numbers those were that were in that?
The definition is really guided by federal legislation. So it's not Minnesota or our study team that changes the definition. So over time, one of the things that's happened is that as they've identified youth at risk, they've identified youth that are doubled up for short periods of time, and who may in fact make up the majority of those who are homeless. But those are short-term episodes. Our study is, because it uses shelters as the base for identifying individual youth, and because we also do outreach using the staff of service providers, we identify interview individuals who are probably more system connected. And so many of the youth that are below the radar are youth that are not really identified in the study. Our 4,000 estimate is of all youth throughout the state who are spending one night, the night that we count, either outdoors, in a shelter, or in some other place, such as a short-term stay with a friend or family member. But the 4,000 number includes that. The 1,000 number that we talk about and the numbers that we interview, those are all homeless youth. Very few of those are doubled up. Very few in that population are doubled up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned in your information here that there were about 4,000 some youths that are counted as homeless every night.
Yes.
I think I saw that in the data here. I was just curious if you had any information, if you extended that out over a year, if it's the same individuals that are chronically in this state of condition, or if they're kind of in and out and find a place, and that it's, you know, how many are new inductees into an unpopular area that need to be helped?
Mr. Owen.
The 4,000 is an estimated number that we use. It's not an actual count. So the actual count is the 1,151 who we actually counted on the night of the study. We think that those 4,000, a good proportion of those are the kids that are homeless for very short periods of time in crisis and then come out of it, so they might need some type of support services or family services to get them help to go back home. But we don't know the exact proportion. When we look at the population that we've actually studied, that 1,151, more and more kids are homeless for longer periods of time over the course of the time we've been doing this study. So we've had fewer kids homeless for just, you know, a week or two showing up in shelters. It's more kids who actually show up. They've been homeless for longer periods of time.
Has that hurt us?
Okay, thank you for that. That helps a little bit. And I guess I was concerned that maybe, you know, we try and house people with these problems, but you identified a whole litany of groups and categories and percentages of different issues. And, you know, what we're doing to solve those problems, which lead to the problem in which we're expending public resources for. So I think some type of longitudinal study about, you know, how big this population really is might help to serve that population and not create a circumstance in which they find themselves maybe hard to get out of.
Among the longitudinal studies that have been done of this population, it looks like from research that we've shared at the U.S. Census Bureau conference on this topic, Paul Toro in Michigan has reported in longitudinal studies that approximately a third of all the youth that he finds as youth, when followed longitudinally, end up as homeless adults. We also know that the proportion of adults that are in our homeless population today who report that they were first homeless as children has well more than doubled over the course of the study period. So it does appear that efforts that are designed to intervene early and potentially break the cycle for a young person could be meaningful efforts for them being able to stay out of homelessness as adults.
Thank you for that.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Being this is a finance committee, I got to ask a finance question. I see your request last year was for about $8 million, and you received about $4 million in funding. So my question is that original funding all allocated? Or had you planned on using it all in the first year and coming back again this year? What's the game plan, I guess?
Representative Halverson?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I do have greater detail in my presentation of the bill because of the timing. We asked these testifiers to come up and present the study because I know that they have to leave, and I can walk through the rest of the bill in greater detail and if there's no more questions for these guys.
Okay, we'll come back to that. Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It actually kind of pertains more to the money as well.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if the testifiers can speak to that or if the author, but do you have an anticipation of how many youth can be served with the $4 million?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think, and Representative O'Neill, I think that that's going to be addressed in later testimony, so we maybe could put a pin in that.
I have a question. When you said that 20% of the youth have traumatic brain injury, can you describe what that brain injury is from? It almost sounds a little bit like we're talking about people returning from war.
We asked a series of questions. Have you ever been hit on the head so you saw stars or were knocked out? And then we ask follow-up questions. Have you had problems with your memory since that time? So it's not, we don't ask directly, do you have a traumatic brain injury, because I don't think a lot of the youth or the folks that we've talked to would really be able to identify that particularly, but we ask about the symptoms.
We don't, in terms of the origins of the problems, we don't ask follow-up questions about how this injury occurred or where it occurred. There's about 300 questions in the interview as it is. It takes almost 45 minutes to administer this survey to a youth. They're done one-on-one, face-to-face by 1,200 volunteers that spread out across the state to do this work. And so not all questions are followed up. That's a very good question to ask, but we don't have data on that from our study.
All right, thank you. All right, any other questions from these witnesses? It sounds like if you need to be excused, you can be.
Thank
you for coming. And Representative Halverson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members, for allowing us the flexibility to do things a little bit out of order. And so I would just like to go through in a little more detail to the questions, the details of this particular bill. This committee did hear the Homeless Youth Act last year, and you may recall that the Homeless Youth Act in Minnesota was actually first passed back in 2006 to establish RFPs for organizations that are providing housing, street outreach, drop-in centers, transitional housing for people who are age 16 to 21 who are homeless or at risk of being homeless. There was a one-time appropriation then of $1 million that got used up quickly, and there was an evaluation done by Rainbow Research that showed that the services were quite effective. However, in light of the recession, we didn't see additional base appropriation funding other than about $119,000 per year until 2013. When $4 million was appropriated over the biennium. There was an RFP that was issued on July 1st, and the DHS received $20 million in applications from 51 organizations statewide. It's important to note that this is a statewide issue and that we're receiving requests from across the state. I took this on as a suburban legislator because youth homelessness is a big issue in my district. We actually, in Dakota County, Egan is home to the only shelter that is serving youth that have aged out of foster care. And we have had a full waiting list, full capacity waiting list for that since Lincoln Place opened. It's a remarkable place to visit because these are folks that are at the most vulnerable stage of their life, I would say, in terms of being homeless. These are people who, as somebody once said, somebody let them down, and now we're stepping up to offer services to them at a time when they're starting their first job or needing to graduate from high school or needing to start college, essentially putting the building blocks in place for what their future is going to be like. And so intervention at this age is incredibly important. That's why the demand has been so great. $10 million worth of the applications were assessed by DHS as programs that were ready to go. They could open their doors tomorrow or start serving youth tomorrow, essentially. However, because of the limited amount of granting funds available, only 30 grants were awarded, and they were at less than the dollars that were requested. So we have yet to be able to fund these programs as they need to be fully implemented throughout the state of Minnesota. I do believe that the committee did get a couple of handouts that show how the distributions were sent out, and that there was a list of grantees and their locations. So,
Representative Halverson, we do have that. It's on the page of the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and lists the grantees.
Thank you. And so that is why I'm back before you this year. I certainly was very grateful to find the support for the half-level funding that was requested. And I'll tell you that in 2007, DHS studied the issue of youth homelessness in Minnesota and determined that $8 million of funding in 2007 would make a significant impact in our youth homeless population. As we know, that funding level has never been achieved. We've never come close to it until last year. And so I think that we're looking at a situation where $8 million will make a tremendous difference in our state. Economically, it costs the state about $750,000 for every youth that doesn't graduate from high school. Youth who don't graduate from high school earn about $476,000 less in their lifetime than a high school graduate does. Society gets about a 4-to-1 return for every dollar invested. So instead of these kids having interactions with Department of Human Services or healthcare costs, creating additional healthcare costs, or finding themselves in the criminal justice system, we are intervening early so that we are saving those dollars and spending them appropriately to get folks independent early in their lives. And I'll tell you, as I meet these guys, these dollars really do matter. When you've got somebody who has been so innovative as to be unable to, as a teenager, put a roof over their head or find something to eat when they have no money or go to school when they're homeless. And these are kids, like I said, I live in Eagan, Minnesota. And these are kids in my community, and I know that they're in all of our communities. There's almost no better dollars we can invest because these kids are so motivated and have done so much for themselves that with a little bit of support, with a little bit of loving intervention from organizations around our state, these dollars come back to us at a 4-to-1 ratio. So I ask for your support for an additional $4 million to the base of the Homeless Youth Act, and we'll make significant progress together addressing youth homelessness in Minnesota. So with that, I would like to hear from the testifiers or answer your questions.
Yeah, there were two people who had, I think, questions related to finance. I think Representative Anderson, you were first, and then Representative O'Neill.
Should I repeat my question?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, thanks, Madam Chair. I was just...
I'm sorry. Did you have some more witnesses? I didn't realize that.
That's okay. But we can answer this question because that was certainly related to my testimony. And
okay.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative.
We'll come back to you. All right. You can stay there.
Just wondering about the plan going forward. You got the half your request last year. And is that funding all spoken for or allocated? And is the additional request part of any additional appropriations by the governor, or where is the money going to come from?
Representative Hobson.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, this bill goes to Health and Human Services Finance next, so it would come out of whatever target HHS Finance has. In regard to the $4 million that got snapped up immediately, we were about $16 million short of requests. But in terms of the requests that we're ready to go, $8 million just about gets us to where the requests that we're ready to go. But because about $10 million worth of the requests were deemed by DHS to be projects that were ready to go that could immediately start serving youth. So gets us pretty close.
Representative O'Neill?
Yes, I'll ask the question again. Thank you, Madam Chair. So in the testimony, I didn't hear really how many you anticipate on serving with the the 4 million.
Representative Halverson.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And in terms of numbers, I believe that there's somebody who is better poised to answer that question than me from one of our service organizations.
I believe you have somebody coming down. And then, young man, we're going to come to you right after that, so you can just hang around real close. Welcome to the committee. If you introduce yourself, please.
Madam Chair, Francie Mathis from Department of Human Services. With the $4,238,000 for the biennium last year, we funded 38 emergency crisis shelter beds and 302 transitional living supportive housing units. So while I don't have the exact number of kids, I do have the number of beds. We also funded 19 grants that were in the prevention outreach drop-in center kind of area, and I do not today have a number for that, but we can get an estimated or a projected number to you if you would like that.
Yeah. Representative O'Neill?
Yeah, I think that would be helpful, especially since you're talking about ongoing appropriations. It would be nice to know how many individuals I understand the beds, but people come in and out and they go through if it's emergency beds. So it would be very good to know how many people we're actually serving as opposed to paying for the bed. That would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. So, Representative Hobson, you have a witness you'd like to introduce to the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair.
My name is Alberto Day, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for listening to my story. My name is Alberto Day, obviously. I was formerly a homeless youth at the age of 17, and I now live in a transitional living place in Minneapolis. When I was homeless, I was roaming around the streets, riding on buses, riding the light rail for hours, trying to get 30 minutes of sleep, sleeping at IHOP in Bloomington, and just living, sometimes just living for a few friends. But then the parents were like, why do you have a homeless friend? And so it's kind of hard. And then one of my friends I used to go to school with, I used to live like near him for a while, and he told me about a place called YouthLink. It's a home where homeless youth can go if they need help. I was skeptical because I was like, I'm not homeless, but in reality, I really was. And I had my pride, so I couldn't really, didn't want to say I was homeless. Who does? But I went there, and I saw kids my age or younger talking to staff and enjoying themselves and being proud that to say, hey, I need some help, and I want to achieve something rather than being homeless. I continued going there, and it was they helped me find where I live right now, which is St. Barnabas in downtown Minneapolis, a place to live. They also help with GED, getting help you look for a job, help you look for a place to live, but they don't like give you what you need. They push you to doing it. So and I didn't, like right now, I'm kind of scared talking to all of you older people who have better jobs than me.
You're doing a great job.
Thank you. But 3 years ago, I probably couldn't be up here. I wouldn't be up here. And I'm right today, I'm sick, but I heard that this money could help people like me or future homeless people. So I was excited about doing it. And even if I'm sick, I wanted to come. And right now I'm in college part-time, and I'm working a part-time job. And when I was homeless, the reason I left was because me and my parents were had arguments and we got in fist fights and we weren't really on good terms, like not really on good terms, and so I left. And now the caseworkers who live in who help us in my building, they help me in a way, help me gain a healthy relationship with my mom. And it's just that, like, this money will really help a lot of kids. Like, you might not think it's not gonna, but it really will. So thank you for listening.
Thank you, Mr. Day. Any questions or comments from committee members? Representative Hertas.
Just a comment. Was nice to hear your story, and it's encouraging to hear that things are moving in a positive direction for you. When I was very young, I thought my parents were about the most stupidest thing that ever existed, and a few years later, I was amazed at how much they had learned.
Thank you very much. I do have a question as well, Mr. Day. You know, you mentioned something that I have understood a lot of homeless youth have had to do, which is to ride public transportation. And did you find, I guess just a couple questions. I know that for a period of time, at least in Minneapolis, when there was no place that youth could go in the evening, there might be a place they could go during the day, and then at evening they were given a bus ticket to go ride the bus all night. Is that what happened to you? Did you have to come up with your own money, or did somebody provide you with?
The Youth Link helped me, gave us tokens, like one or two tokens, mm-hmm. but there's like where the Youth Link is located downtown Minneapolis, so mm-hmm. you could go to Hope Street, Safe Zone in St. Paul, so there's different places, or you could ride the train. I didn't feel comfortable in those type of places. Other people have, but I just didn't, and probably because I've been to Salvation Army, which is not for youth, it's for mm-hmm. older people. So right. I guess that's where I didn't get my comfortableness from. So I just rode the trains and went to IHOP and stayed at the mall, the little drop-in thing, where you sit for the train. So yeah, that's. Okay. But you do get provided with tokens and mm-hmm. little bus slips. So yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to say, members, I find it unacceptable that in the face of having no shelters that we provide tokens for our young people to ride a public transportation instead of providing any sort of shelter. So I guess you're just a good example of a person who made the best of not only that, but then you got yourself out of that situation. So thank you for your testimony. Really appreciate it. Any other witnesses? And Representative Halverson?
Yes, I got.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Chair Clark and members of the committee. I am Patrice O'Leary, Senior Director of Youth Services for Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. We provide services to homeless youth in the Twin Cities and the surrounding regions of Duluth, Brainerd, Wilmer, Mankato, and Rochester. Thank you for directing funding into the Homeless Youth Act last session. This winter, in spite of extreme weather conditions, youth continue to be forced to find shelter outside and in places not meant for human habitation. In Wilmer, this winter, homeless youth found shelter at the Candy Ojai Area Transit Bus Shelter in the sheds located behind the Candy Mall parking lot at Robbins Island Park, in the Walmart entrance, under the bleachers at Roosevelt School, in the stairwell of the public library, in their cars, squatting in a vacant apartment, and in apartment stairwells. In Brainerd, homeless youth found shelter living in a conversion van, keeping the engine running all night, downtown on the stairways to apartments, in a fish house, under the bridge over the Mississippi River, in the woods, at a campground, and squatting in a foreclosed home. In Rochester, homeless youth found shelter in their cars, in the subway system, which is an underground tunnel system in downtown Rochester, in the laundromat, in Mayo Clinic buildings, and couch hopping. In Duluth, homeless youth found shelter walking around Walmart all night, wrapped up in a sleeping bag behind a snowbank. At UMD, where there is a studying room available all night, sleeping in a chair out of everyone's sight. We also think that some of the youth in Duluth have gone to the emergency room for shelter. They go after midnight with some sort of pain, nebulous pain, stomach pain, for example, stay several hours, and have lots of tests with no physical symptoms. What do these young people need? They need help to reach their goals. one young man who was staying at Robbins Island Park left foster care at age 18 and was unwelcome in the adopted home that he was adopted into and at early childhood. He requested to return to care but was denied by his home county. He slept in several places in Wilmer, including Robbins Island. LSS Youth Services discovered that what he really wanted to do was go to the Job Corps in St. Paul. He is currently being sheltered safely until he can enter the Job Corps at the end of the month. He is looking forward to this, to receiving his education and learning skills to be on his own and to have a job working with his hands. He's thinking about masonry. These young people need help to find affordable housing. A young couple with a toddler and another child due in the next month were sleeping in a minivan during the mid-January deep freeze when the temperatures were so terribly dangerous. They survived by running the vehicle all night, which consumed a great deal of the paycheck that one of the youth had coming in. The van was parked in the driveway where one of the youth's mothers lived, but they were no longer allowed either to stay in her apartment or to keep their van in the parking lot for risk of her eviction. They finally came into LSS Youth Services because the landlord had seen them there, and they were demanded to leave the property. These youth, one of them having a disability, are now living in a permanent supportive housing program, and they're all safe. These youth need some caring adults in their lives. A 17-year-old came in looking for support services because his mother had died and his father had committed suicide when he was 15 years old. He had been taking care of his terminally ill mother for several years, and he has no other family. He is trying his best to pay all the bills, and he's dropped out of school in order to work. He is currently still in the apartment that he and his mother were renting, but he's falling behind on the bills and falling behind on rent. Resources for Minnesota's rural youth are few and far between. Lutheran Social Service discovered through a demonstration project to build services for rural homeless youth that what rural youth need is local community resources that are accessible to them. I urge you to further fund the Homeless Youth Act so that homeless youth and those at risk of homelessness, especially the 40% of homeless youth who are in rural Minnesota, have access to the resources they need to transition safely to adulthood.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions, comments for Ms. O'Leary? No? Okay. Thank you very much for all your testimony, and Representative Halverson, I think your bill is before us now, and Representative Fisher? Was it your? No, Representative Isaacson, excuse me. Renews his motion to refer this to Health and Human Services. House File 2203. Health and Human Services, Finance. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and you're on your way to Health and Human Services, Finance. Thank you very much. So excellent testimony. We have one more bill. Representative Moran. Your committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm going to move your bill.
Yes, I would like to move House File 2251 to be referred to civil law.
All right. Motion is before us. You want to go ahead and explain your bill?
Okay. House File 2251 is not in opposition to landlords, but rather provides an equitable balance in our system of law of due process, which is innocent until proven guilty. And so I'm going to stop there and just invite my first testifier to come down and testify. Okay. And I believe that would be Andy Barnett.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
It's right here. Mr. Barnett.
My name is Andy Barnett. I work with the Frogtown Rondo Home Fund. I have over two decades of experience working in affordable housing and neighborhood development in both urban settings and rural settings. And I support the common sense modifications to the disclosure and expungement of evictions in House File 2251. This bill strikes a better balance between the rights of property owners and tenants than current law. Property owners have the right to information about the rental history of potential tenants in order to protect their property, manage risk in their asset portfolio. In fact, reasonable tenant screening practices should be encouraged. However, our current law creates unnecessary barriers to housing for many Minnesotans. In many parts of the state, both in the metro area and in some of our regional centers, are experiencing unusually tight rental housing markets, very low vacancy rates for folks seeking rental housing. In these markets, property owners are able to take advantage of their access to rental history, credit scores, and criminal background to erect unnecessary barriers to tenants. The tenants most likely to be left out of housing in this scenario are households who have been left out of economic prosperity in general. People of color, long-term tenants, all bear this brunt disproportionately. This bill removes the most punitive aspects of the current law. It shields eviction orders from public record until the case against the tenant has been decided. This is a simple issue of due process, ensuring that tenants are not penalized before the case is decided. Excuse me just a second. Let me scroll down to the next. It makes expungement automatic in cases that are decided in favor of the tenant. Right now, a tenant would have to go back and file for a separate expungement, even if the eviction order is ruled in their favor. This bill would make it so that they don't have that cost. They also don't have the stigma that's attached with eviction orders in cases that were unfounded. It also creates a common sense limit on accountability by expunging eviction orders after 3 years. This preserves a property owner's access to information to make tenant selection decisions without creating a permanent barrier to housing for tenants who've experienced an eviction due to temporary financial hardship or some other one-time event in their life. By removing these barriers to housing, you increase the tenant's choice in the rental market, give them access to housing that may be more suitable than they can currently lease. Tenants with poor rental history are increasingly now forced to look for housing where the landlord doesn't do any type of tenant screening. These properties are concentrated in areas with very low housing costs and often managed by owners who cut other corners other than just tenant screening in their property management. As a result, too many of these families find themselves paying a premium in order to lease barely adequate housing because of a long past or wrongfully disclosed eviction order. This bill, I believe, corrects that imbalance and will increase access to housing for many Minnesota tenants. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Bennett from any members? Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you let me know how many other states have this exact same law, statute like this?
Ms. Bennett?
I don't know. I can find that out for you and report back to the committee.
The author?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have those facts neither, but we try to get them to you.
Representative O'Neill?
I guess I'm having a hard time understanding the unnecessary barriers. So if they have been evicted and it's back 3 years and a landlord looks at that, are you saying the landlord's not going to rent to them if they can still see it 3 years ago? What if it was 4 years ago? I mean, I guess I'm having a hard time understanding this. I don't know if you've got testifiers that'll come up that have experienced this. Okay.
Yes.
Maybe I'll just wait then until they speak. But I'm having a hard time understanding the barriers. You know, if you've got bad credit and you've got other things, but this doesn't pertain to that. This just pertains to, you know, if they've already been evicted and that's on their record. So how does this, because you also have bad credit, you have other things that landlords look at. So I'm having a hard time understanding how this rectifies the situation, I guess. Maybe if you could just expound on that a bit before more testifiers come up.
Yeah, I
Mr.
think
Bennett?
What we're looking at in tighter rental markets is sort of the accumulation of all of these different factors, because they're all there's no limit to what to what a landlord can look at in screening. So you may have a two comparable tenants, let's say one with an eviction on their record, 2 years ago, and one 4 years ago, and similar in every other way of credit score and criminal background and those sorts of things. Right now, those would they would show up as equal, in the scoring. So, the older the eviction order is, it doesn't minimize its presence in the tenant's rental history, and therefore the barrier that it creates for them in getting housing. That basically never goes away. It also, this bill addresses the fact that many of the eviction orders that show up on a tenant's rental history may be there for cases that haven't yet been decided, or cases that were decided in favor of the tenant, but they for whatever reason never bothered to file to have that eviction order expunged from their rental history.
Madam Chair, may I have a follow-up, please?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have some statistics as to how prevalent this issue would be and how this particular remedy would affect? I mean, do you have any numbers, or can you give us a little more understanding of the prevalence of this and how this particular change would remedy that?
I think
Mr. Bennett?
Some of the other folks that are testifying would be able to speak Bennett. To that in more detail than I can.
So, Madam
okay,
Chair.
Okay, maybe we should get to your other witnesses, it sounds like it.
Time.
Okay. Representative Anderson is for this witness.
Just a quick question, Madam Chair. Thank you. To the witness, you've made mention a couple of times of the tight rental market. Mm-hmm. So because the rental market is tighter, mm-hmm. you feel these background expungement things should not be carried on as long? Or to me, that seemed like a separate issue, just because the market is tight, that the landlord should not be able to go back 3 years or more to check background. Mm-hmm. I find that relationship not quite what I would agree with, I guess.
Okay.
Mr. Barnett.
Address the chair.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I think the connection there is that the tighter the rental market, the choosier the property owner, property manager can be in selecting tenants. And so the more interested they'll be in, in using all of the different information that's available to them about the prospective tenant to select a tenant that's going to in their mind perform the best in the unit. So that's the connection. We see a lot, some of the reasons the rental market is tighter, we have a lot of folks who were former homeowners who were foreclosed upon, who are now in the rental market. They have a different profile than many of the folks who are longtime tenants do. And so again, that's what starts to create that the connection between how long eviction orders remain on someone's record and the condition in the housing market.
And Madam Chair, also to speak on that, what this bill does also in connection with that is that currently what happens is if a landlord decides to evict a tenant from a rental, immediately a UD goes onto its record, immediately, even before they go to court. And what we're saying is that even when they go into the due process of going to court, many times, not all the times, that a tenant may be found innocent of that UD, but that UD is still on their permanent record. And when they try to go for in search of another housing opportunity, that barrier is there because that UD or that process has not been expunged or taken off of their permanent record. And it really creates a barrier to access to housing. And so what we're asking here And some, I think right now, currently, you have to go back at least 10 years, right? So if 10 years of an expungement, that's a factor into renting. And so what we are saying with this bill is that that UD from that eviction would not go onto a tenant permanent record until due process has taken place.
Okay. Representative Green, is it for this witness, or are we...
I think so. If it's not, I'll ask the question. If you can't answer it, I'll wait. That's all right?
All right, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Because you were talking about the withholding or expunging this or before it even goes to court, there's a couple of things. One, as I understand it, a renter or a landlord is responsible for the actions of his tenants. Now, is there going to be some legal issue here if a landlord then can't get the records of a tenant that has, say, destroyed or in maybe, let's take a worst case scenario, has been cooking meth in an apartment, and now a landlord rents to that person who's been evicted because there's no record? Is there any legal ramifications for the landlord because he's responsible for that?
Yeah,
Mr. Burnett, or Representative Moran.
I think those are factors that we need to take into consideration as we move this bill through. But again, what I think would be even better, I have someone here. This is the work that they do, and the who would be better informed to speak on behalf of your questions.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and have our other witness, Representative Green, you can go. Thank you, Mr. Burnett. Mr. Giles. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Just introduce yourself, please.
I'm Metric M. Giles the First. I'm the director at the Community Stabilization Project. And I would like to address the last question, Madam Chair.
Right ahead.
Members. The last question. In reference to a criminal record, if it's meth, if it's other crimes, that's going to always be available on a person's record. You know, we aren't saying let's remove all persons' records. And what I really would like to address here is that we have, someone asked about other states. I haven't looked at all the states. I looked at Wisconsin state laws referring to tenant landlords. They're terrible. No, I was appalled. I was very happy to live in the state of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And I'm just saying that if we look at justice and equity, that's what this law and amendment is about, justice and equity. And so we have the eviction law as it stands. So just for clarity on the eviction law, what is it? It gives the right for the landlord to bring a tenant to court for non-payment of rent, failure to recognize an eviction order, and for breaking rules of the rental agreement. It gives that any landlord that right. Now, just because they have the right to do that, we go back to the due process, that it doesn't mean that the tenant is guilty of those issues. In many cases, especially, I can go over those, non-payment of rent. It could be an illegal rent increase. There could be abatements that is due to the tenant. And those are, because we have a due process of the court, the tenant can come into court with the amount that is due, and the judge or the hearing officer can rule in favor of the tenant. In cases of evictions, a landlord can give a tenant an illegal eviction notice. Mm-hmm. A legal eviction notice is whatever is deemed by the lease, and if there's no other written agreement, a legal eviction notice is whatever is deemed by the lease, and if there's no other written agreement, is based on a full rental period's notice. Meaning, if the tenant gets the notice on the first of the month, that they must be out at the end of the month, that is an illegal eviction notice. termination. It's not really even an eviction notice, but it's just a termination notice. And that notice would be deemed as being illegal. And the tenant would actually do not have to move, but the tenant, the landlord does have the right to bring the tenant to court for that. Again, the ruling can be in favor of the tenant. The breaking rules of the lease, that's very, you know, depending on the circumstances. But again, that can be in the ruling of the tenant. Mm-hmm. So what happens here? The landlord files the eviction notice. Immediately, it goes on public record. Immediately, it impacts the tenant before the due process happens. That's as far as the constitutions and everything else, I know that's not justice, you know, to be found guilty. Can I continue?
Go right ahead.
All right. So if we talk about they get to court and they're vindicated, if the ruling is in favor of the tenant, and the tenant is very, very happy. Wow, I won. They go back home. A year later, they're trying to rent a place. And they put in an application. What comes up? You have an eviction order on your record. And the tenant said, well, I won. No one in the court said to that tenant, okay, you won. But one, you need to ask the judge for an expungement. And or you need to now file for an expungement. The tenant is totally do not know that. Now, as far as the safety umbrella of the court and protecting our rights of the people, we're saying that should be an automatic thing that happens. No, it should not be based on ignorance of your not knowing what your rights are. That rights and policies are made to protect the people. The termination of 3 years right now is for a lifetime. Now, maybe the person the ruling was in favor of the tenant, or the landlord, excuse me. The landlord filed a legal eviction notice. The tenant did not move. The tenant was there for non-payment rent. The tenant did break rules of the rental agreement. Yes. Now, let's figure out how long do that tenant need to be accountable and deal with the consequences of that. We do not think it should be a lifetime. Now, on the reporting, on the record, reporting agencies have 7 years in which that they can report on. Now, when that went into effect, I'm quite sure we did not have the technology that we have right now. Bigger corporate agencies probably still use a lot of reporting agencies. It's pretty easy. Someone asked me about something. What do I say? I say Google it. Just Google it and you can get the answer. People now can go to and Google it and go to their own public records and have accessibility to the public records. And that's for a lifetime right now. So we are not saying that people should not be held accountable. But we are saying it should not be a lifetime of accessibility. I have clients, customers that come into the office who have moved to the state of Minnesota because of the justice, other opportunities that are offered here. And then when they go to find housing, the landlords or the reporting agencies, they are coming up with UDs that are from other states. So we're saying we cannot control what other states do, such as Wisconsin and other places. But we are saying that we here can still act in a just and an equitable way. And I want to talk about the numbers. I do not have a list of statistics that says this impacted 5,000 people or that impacted 10 people right now. But I do know we have a housing court. If you go to that housing court, it's filled up with people every day who are receiving eviction orders. Every day of the week, there's housing court. So It's a reality. And so it's not so much the statistics, as I said earlier. We're talking about justice and equity and having a fairness in housing. I just heard you guys review a bill for homelessness. It would be, in my mind, which is limited, but you're speaking about homelessness and trying to prevent homelessness. And the way that bill stands right now is it's a tunnel to create homelessness, not only for housing, for in the employment area. When people look at people's record, when they see a lack of accountability, it makes a difference. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I think there was a question from Representative O'Neill and then Representative Anderson. And then we have one more witness, members.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just very quickly, help me understand this just a little bit. So with an eviction notice, if the court finds in favor of the tenant, is that also not a part of the court record? So a prospective landlord could look at that court document and say they were found innocent? I don't understand what the purpose of this is. If it should all be part of the court record if they were found innocent. Isn't that correct?
I would say there's a difference, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. members. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe I'm wrong on this, but court records and public records are two different things. And we're talking about public records here. And most landlords are not going to court records. If they look at the public records and they see, as one of the representatives asked, they see a meth charge on there or a criminal record, then they will go to the court records and find more details on it.
Representative O'Neill?
So you're saying that the eviction is part of the public record,
yes.
but not the finding of the court saying that they were innocent?
The details of what happened in court actually is not part of what a person is going to look at, those finer details of what really happened within the courts. And so I don't know if that answers your question.
So final follow-up, and then I actually have to go, so Representative Anderson can finish. But but there is a procedure now where they can ask for expungement already. They would just have to do it after the fact, after the court finding. Is that correct?
Ms. Giles.
Madam Chair, member, there is a procedure, but once again, as Andy Barnett spoke to, of the common sense. I am brought to eviction court, housing court, and I'm vindicated of that. Now, if I'm vindicated of that, why do I have to, number one, deal with a public record, and why do I have to have that public record removed for something that I have been vindicated? So, yes, they can do that, but from a common sense place, why do I have to do that for something that I was found innocent of?
Okay. Representative Anderson?
Thanks again. Just a couple quick questions, and I enjoyed listening to you, sir. I understand where you're coming from between when the notice is filed and when there's final disposition. Can you give me some idea of the timeline? Because that's what we're talking about here, that time during which the claim is filed and when it's disposed of. How long does that usually take?
Well,
Madam Chair, Representative, right now, when the landlord files the UD, it immediately becomes part of public records. Now, I don't know if that's 24 hours, if it's a day, but what has happened is that because the landlord, a tenant is seeking new housing, and that eviction order is out there, and they haven't been to court, a landlord can go, or even an employer or someone else can go to those public records and see that there's an eviction order on that person's record before a hearing has ever happened. Now, that's where it stands right now. Once again, not a common sense of justice, a practice of justice.
Representative Anderson.
But again, I'm just trying to find out how long this whole process might take. Are we talking a couple days, a week, a month?
Okay, no. Court process, Madam Chair. When a landlord files the eviction order, there's a process and procedure that must happen. as far as the passing the eviction order, the notice to appear in court to the tenant. And the landlord themselves cannot do that. But usually, for the record, it's 7 to 14 days that it gives a tenant to appear in court. And then when they get to court, there might even be further hearings after that. That's just the initial appearance.
Okay, thank you. Members, we do have one more witness who's asked to be. Thank you, Ms. Giles.
Madam Chair, I had two actual tenants here who was to appear today. Okay. One of them is a person from Chicago who has came into our office, and we actually has helped her to avoid having the eviction file against her through kind of like working with her landlord, housing codes and stuff. She has a mother who is ill, and she reported that she could not make it due to her mother's illness in the house.
Okay.
So they are not here.
They're not here. Okay. I think we need to, we have one person who wants to testify, I think, maybe in opposition. I'm not really sure. I want to make sure we give a chance to that person, and then we'll be take a vote.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do I just have a couple minutes? Is that?
Mm-hmm, that's right. I'm sorry we're running late, but go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Todd Logenquist. I represent the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, and we do oppose the bill for a number of reasons and a lot of consequences that may result out of this bill. Eviction records are a key piece of information for landlords when they're screening their residents. The Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act defines renting as a credit consumer transaction, and credit practices hinge on the notion that past practices are a primary indicator of future behaviors. Good credit practice requires that landlords rent to customers who are able and willing to pay their rent. If tenants are not paying their rent, that is a primary means of driving the property into foreclosure. And in regards to expungement of eviction records after 3 years, it's not just the credit information that is no longer available, but it's lease violations and even some criminal activity that the police force may not have pressed charges, may not have even made an arrest in those situations. So as to some comments made earlier, that there are situations where criminal activity has occurred that could be expunged after 3 years, but just because the law enforcement officials did not proceed with charges and did not actually make an arrest, that might not be in the criminal record. And even if it is in the criminal record, the criminal actions proceed at a different pace as to than civil actions, which is what an eviction action is. Many cities, which was mentioned before, many cities have rental licensing as part of the rental licensing programs. They have conduct on licensed premises to which the landlord can be held responsible for. And if certain activities occur at the property, the landlord has to take action against those activities, or he or she could lose their property. All the way, there are penalties all the way up to and including losing their rental property. Cities have taken a very active role in screening, in encouraging residents to screen. Some cities actually require landlords to screen their residents. Public records are public. The Supreme Court rules of public access require the records to be open, and there's a presumption that public records, which is why the criminal expungement bill that has been moving its way through has seen so much attention. There is a current process for expunging eviction records, and there's a standard that must be met when those eviction records are expunged, and that process, anyone can make a motion after a hearing and request that those records be expunged. So if a tenant successfully defends himself in an eviction hearing, they have an opportunity to make a motion and have a separate expungement hearing. This bill restricts all relevant current eviction information. So if someone files an eviction action against someone, that tenant could immediately go to another prospective landlord and seek a rental unit from that prospective landlord. And the reason for filing the eviction might not even be non-payment. It could be any number of criminal activities to which the landlord would be absolutely would have no access to that information. And finally, Madam Chair, as I read the bill, it appears to require an expungement decision to be made on every eviction hearing at every eviction action, which I believe significantly increases the costs of the court system, because a separate determination would have to be made not only on the merits of the eviction action, but as to the expungement motion. Actually, a motion wouldn't even have to be made. So every eviction action would have to have a determination of the validity of expungement. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any comments or questions for committee members? Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That brings up a question for me, too. Now, it says in here that if it goes to court, the tenant can't be held liable for any costs, win or lose. If the tenant loses and every case is in court, who picks up the cost? And I'll ask the author.
Okay.
If she.
I'm going to defer that question to Mr. Giles.
Madam Chair, quickly as you can.
No, it does not say that. That is not the reference of the bill, and if it does say that, that's incorrect. We're only referring to the case where tenants are vindicated, and if a tenant actually is not vindicated, it goes. That's part of the filing automatically with any non-payment of rent, and any cost does go and stays with the tenant. And we're not asking for cost of money to be added, as the gentleman stated. We're saying the judge would just simply say, all right, it has been ruled in favor of the tenant. This should not be on their public record, and they should not incur any expenses. That's simple. It does not cost any money to say that.
Representative Green?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will say that there will be money involved in this, but and I will also tell you, I don't disagree with you in that, you know, if you do get taken to court and you win your case against being evicted, then I would say that in that case it should be off the record. But this bill does tremendously more than that, and there's a lot of problems with this bill that really I'm not getting the answers to the questions here, and I think that we're looking at a fiscal note on this, and I would like to hold off on this till some of these questions can be answered.
One thing to point out, Representative Green, this bill will go to civil law next, where I think some of those questions, if they're still hanging, they can be answered. I think. Representative Moran, did you have any comments?
So I just want to close by saying that we're not asking, you know, landlords to not take action or not to screen or rent and have good tenants. We want that. But what we're just simply asking is that would happen with due process, and the UD would not be placed on a tenant record before they have been before that case has been decided.
Representative Green?
Thank you, Madam Chair. But the bill says more than that. I mean, the bill goes far beyond that. But, you know, at this point, Madam Chair, I don't think we have a quorum to even vote this forward.
You are correct. I look around, we don't have a quorum. So I think we'll have to temporarily lay the bill over, and we'll be back on Monday, Monday with your bill for final determination.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further business to come before the committee? I guess we can't do anything more, including the minutes. So, committee members, the committee is adjourned.